Welcome to Credit Exchange, your podcast for all things credit, where we speak to the biggest newsmakers and news shapers in finance. I'm your host, Lisa Lee. This week, my guest is David Miller, Global Head of Private Credit and Equity at Morgan Stanley Investment Management, where he runs a team of 150 professionals providing capital mainly to mid-sized companies. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
This week, all focus is on the snowy Alps in Switzerland at the World Economic Forum in Davos. That's because President Donald Trump is there. In his Davos speech in front of the world's leaders, he once again demanded Greenland, though he did rule out using force, and addressed other topics including the international trade order, immigration, and NATO. David, as an investor with 28 years of experience, including this important seat at Morgan Stanley and a stint at the U.S. Treasury Department, how do you assess all these geopolitical headlines? Because they are constant and they are significant.
It's a really good question. I guess, starting out, I would say, being in the private markets, taking a longer term view of how we invest means we try and avoid looking at the noise that seems to come out very frequently and really try and cut through it. Not worry about the short-term volatility, but really think, what does it do to the long-term fundamentals of the company, the industry, the geography that we're looking at? And so, as you've seen, there's volatility. There has been really, if you look over the past year, lots of headlines, lots of noise. And I think what we do is try and parse that and say, what might change to the fundamentals? Where are labor markets? What's income? What do interest rates do? What are cross-border flows? And so sometimes it's important to step back, not focus so much on the day-to-day headline and try and internalize and then formulate that longer-term view.
So when you formulate the longer-term view, what is your macroeconomic forecast? There's a lot of bullish sentiment that the U.S. economy is going to grow quite a bit. The AI productivity boom is starting to manifest itself. Are you one of those bulls? Are you seeing a robust economic growth and lending and investing in that climate?
Yeah, we're generally pretty, pretty supportive of this economy. You look at the data and you look at what we're seeing sort of in the second half of 25. We're in an environment where, again, labor market is strong. Income, by and large, outside the lower end consumer has been good. Rates are coming down, and that's also supportive. So all of that is pretty conducive to good GDP, good macro growth. And so that's what we're seeing, and we expect that to continue. That's our base case. The capital markets are quite open. We've seen activity levels rise throughout the second half of 25, expected into 26. That's good for activity. That's good for credit. That's good overall for capital formation. So all of those are quite positive. AI was also a big underlier of the economic engine last year and expected to continue. Obviously, a lot of construction of the digital infrastructure required is a tailwind to the economy. And there are a lot of businesses that support that infrastructure build out. So it's not just that AI is going to be productivity enhancing as it diffuses through the economy, just something we look at closely, but it's also the supporting businesses around it to help it grow and ultimately add capacity. So all of those are quite positive. And so our base case is generally looking at the U.S. economy and still being a fairly positive. Clearly, there are risks that abound that could change that view. But right now, despite some of the macro headwinds and certainly geopolitical headlines, we've had Venezuela, we've had Greenland, all of that, doesn't really change the picture yet. But I guess the point I would make, as we look longer term is these headlines might not matter to the markets right now. They might not impact spreads. But over time, you have to look at the impact on confidence and the impact on uncertainty. And as uncertainty rises, risk premium will rise. And so that can change the calculus, but we're not seeing it in the markets yet.
So it could happen. It just is not happening right now, is your take. What would be sort of a market wake-up call? Because it seems like there was Ukraine and there was Venezuela, as you mentioned, and now Greenland. And then we had the Japanese bonds that really spike up, the yield spike up. And yet we seem to constantly shake off every single geopolitical worry, and the market is just booming. Is confidence that high, or are we being a little too sanguine and be caught short-footed?
There are certainly risks out there where I think the magnitude would have a bigger market impact. Right now, the various events that have occurred have been fairly contained and actually not that impactful to the underlying economic engine. And so that's why I think you've seen the response. Clearly, much larger impactful events, if they were to happen, that would spill over into the real economy, I think would get the markets worried. You could see a situation where if it gets escalated in Iran and the Straits of Hormuz are blocked and oil prices spike up, that would have a very significant impact on the real economy. Don't want to go too far into it, but you can envision, you know, if the China-Taiwan situation were to escalate, I think that would have a much more profound impact on markets given the spillover into the real economy.
And it does seem Donald Trump has very big asks, but he does care about the stock market. He does seem to care about economic growth. And so is some of the bet and some of the fact that markets are as calm as they are, is that they've learned that what some people have called taco, Trump always chickens out. But just the idea that was Secretary Bressent said, calm down, it will be okay. And is the market taking that to heart?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if you've looked historically, there have been large, very aggressive asks or statements that ultimately get negotiated to a place that works. And I think that's what the market is expecting now based on the reaction is a little bit of volatility, a little bit of nervousness, and people digest that and expect there to be a solution that works.
So you are the global head of private credit and private equity. So I'm going to first ask you to put your private equity hat on. Because you spoke about confidence. And last year, when confidence was shook with Liberation Day, everything came back. The stock market came back, all-time highs, credit spreads tightened. But M&A and LBOs took a really long time, and maybe LBOs still not yet. Do you expect, are you seeing LBO activity on the horizon? And do you feel confident enough for you to deploy?
So the answer is yes. We did see activity really improve in the second half of the year. Now, we're focused on the broad definition of the middle market. So maybe some of the mm-hmm. deals not that you would see in the large headlines or the big take privates. And activity there has been steadily improving through the course of the year. And so our view is actually we're looking at a multi-year M&A uptick, certainly in the private equity space. And there are really a few reasons underlying that. I think first, you got to start with where private equity is in the life cycle. A lot of capital was raised and deployed in the 2020 to 22 period. There was a huge increase in amount raised, and it was quickly deployed. And then quickly after that, you know, we had COVID, but we had the rate increase in 22. And then deals really ground to a halt. As people were absorbing higher interest rates and a lot of deployment. So now fast forward, there are a lot of portfolio companies that are 5 years, 7 years and older in the portfolios. LPs want capital back. And so that is pushing the private equity firms to really think hard about getting their companies ready for sale. So that's really on the supply. And we think that's coming. Will it spike up in one quarter? Probably not. But it's going to be a slow build. And we think a sustained multi-year increase in activity. At the same time, the economic conditions are quite favorable. You've got good growth, we mentioned. Rates have been coming down, which makes the cost of financing better. And I would argue, you know, rates in the 3-4% range for SOFR. You know, it's a pretty healthy place, pretty conducive to activity. It's also the direction, which has been good. So all of that points to more activity. And so we are seeing an increase. We're seeing, obviously, older companies sell. But the middle market, people forget, there are hundreds of thousands of companies in the middle market. And so it's a really fertile ground to find opportunities, private companies, founder-owned and run companies that are looking for partners to help them transform and grow the company to the next level. And so that's really what we specialize in. And being part of the Morgan Stanley ecosystem really allows us to do that well.
So much of economic growth, as you've mentioned, this year projected and last year, has come from AI. Are middle market size companies, middle market companies that you focus on, are they benefiting from that? And if so, in what way? If not, when do you expect to? Because this AI boom seems all encompassing.
It does, and it will take time to diffuse down across the economy. And in certain places, you know, it is, right? You think about how much easier it is now for companies to write code and programming with some of the new technology out there from Anthropic. So it is changing. I think the middle market companies that want to partner and want to grow, one of the things we're able to do is say, you're not experts in tech. Mm-hmm. You're not experts in cyber, in AI. But we can help you with that because at Morgan Stanley, with 80,000 employees, a massive technology department, we can help bring that to them so they don't have to learn it on their own. And so that helps them get more efficient and bring these tools in a way that in their market, they would never have done so. And that's how they bring it inside the company. But I think if you look at the actual companies, we have focused in certain areas, not in investing necessarily in AI directly, but there is a ton of infrastructure that mm-hmm. is being built up around it that allows us to benefit from those tailwinds without taking technology risks directly. And so recently we invested in a company that really helps design and engineer the data centers and service them. There are lots of boring things to do with the data center that requires technical services. And so we view that as a way to play it versus directly in the technology.
So let's switch to your private credit hat. And before we move on to that, tell me, like, why at Morgan Stanley do you wear both? Because a lot of other firms separate private equity and private credit. So I find it interesting that you had both.
Yeah, we have different teams that are experts and have long standing careers in one or the other. But the logic around it is if you look at the ecosystem of private equity, it really consists of you've got people doing buyouts, you've got growth, but then you also have all of those deals require capital. So they're requiring private credit, they're requiring equity. And so we, over time, realize all of the synergies across both of them, which is to say, our private credit team is predominantly lending to private equity firms. We can bring in the expertise from our private equity side and say, we really know this industry, we really understand how to look at this, and we can do better collectively. Alternatively, one of our private equity businesses is a multi-manager business where we help clients allocate to other private equity firms. So we have a lot of relationships within that ecosystem, and they become natural partners for us on the private credit side. So we are lenders to them. So you take that, and it makes a lot of sense between it. I think the other point I would make is increasingly alternative forms of capital that are not your traditional direct lending, senior secured credit, and they're not buyout equity are coming into more demand. And I'll call those capital solutions, hybrid credit solutions. So we've
No, there isn't a really good name yet, right? Because yeah, I hate that term, solutions.
Could be opportunistic credit as well.
But that sort of hints towards distressed, right? I think the distressed guys took opportunistic credit.
Yeah, so we'll leave that name there. But sort of constructive capital, because we're not distressed players,
yes.
Constructive capital that isn't a very obvious first lien loan that looks a certain way. It's going to be more expensive. It's going to be more tailored. It could be junior capital. That area is a growth area that we quite like. And so that right really sits in between how you mm-hmm. think about the investment from a traditional credit investment or a controlled buyout. And so having the teams together really talking about those underlying companies, those structures, I think gives us a lot of synergy across. And most managers in the middle market do one thing really well, but I think we get a benefit across that, both from deal sourcing as well as innovation and how we think about the companies.
That is true. I do see this convergence between private equity and private credit, the term private capital being used more and more as firms, especially private equity firms, develop their private credit capabilities and realize that, hey, there is this area for both. And to your point, what you said, hybrid capital. Where do you put that? Do you put that in your private equity shop or do you put that in your private credit shop?
Yeah, and look, we look at it as a spectrum of capital. And the nice thing about where we sit is we are looking at the universe of really interesting private middle market companies saying, okay, what are your needs? How can we help you? In some cases, we're looking to buy that company, control it, partner with the founder, and own it for 5, 6, 7 years. But in other cases, they're not looking for that, but they do need capital. It could be a loan. It could be something structured where it's part debt, part equity. There are a lot of reasons why private companies need capital. And so when you play in that middle area, you are looking at what we think are equity-like returns. So it's more expensive than a traditional loan, but it's also very tailored to needs. And so today, and the reason we're excited about this part of the investment landscape is there's just more growth. So there are a lot of companies that are looking to do an acquisition, but they've used their debt capacity. And so they don't have the obvious bank loan or private credit loan. And so they're saying, we love this deal. We don't have more equity. We don't want to dilute our equity. And so you can structure a bespoke instrument for that. There are a lot of growth companies that have raised equity and are absolutely growing and they're deploying cash. And so they want to raise some credit-like instrument that doesn't dilute their prior valuation and their investors. They're looking for capital. And then there's also those that we have to admit there are some companies that were invested in private equity that aren't doing as well as people thought. And sometimes that's simply because they didn't anticipate rates going up 400 or 500 basis points. So they don't want to take more cash bearing interest, or maybe their capital structure is a little off. We can come in and help them reduce the cash pay interest and come in the form of a subordinated debt with PIK interest or preferred stock and give them the runway they need for a few years to execute. That's more expensive, but it's an area that because we're really in tune with the underlying businesses and approach it like a private equity investor, we can find good risk reward.
And now turning to private credit, what's your outlook for the market? With the capital markets open as they are, can they still be growing? Because I know you're a middle market, so you don't compete directly with capital markets, but they do trickle down. And so if you tell me your outlook, that'd be really appreciated.
The direct lending, the biggest part of the private credit markets, have, like all asset classes, you know, gotten a little more expensive, or in this case, spreads have compressed. They mirror the compression in the public credit markets, which are also, you know, pretty close to all-time tights. So I don't think there's been a diminution of the illiquidity premium, but it has come down with public markets. And that's really been a function of overall sentiment has been pretty positive. There have been good inflows into private credit. And as we mentioned before, the number of deals hasn't quite matched the inflow of capital. So I think that those are the reasons why it's been pretty tight. But the environment has been good despite the headlines. Default rates are still very low. The health of portfolios in general is quite good. I think, been some unfounded fears just because there have been some big headline companies that have had challenges. But for the most part, it's performing well. I think our outlook in 26 and 27 is a little bit based on our M&A outlook, which is the supply of companies coming to market and therefore the demand for private credit is going to increase. And that's going to be generally pretty good for spreads. Not that they're going to gap out, but we think it's going to take a little bit of the pressure off deployment. Generally that's positive. At the same time, you've got capital raising has slowed over the past couple of years in private credit. It's still positive, but it's slowed down off of, pretty sharp raises. And those raises were logical. Rates were going up. Investors wanted floating rate exposure. They wanted to capture those premiums. I mean, private credit 2 years ago was yielding well north of 10% in first lien senior secured debt. We knew that wasn't going to last. So you've seen a little bit of reversal of that enthusiasm. So we think supply and demand will become more in sync over the next few years. And so generally, we feel that's positive. The more activity and demand for private credit, the better it is as an investor. You can choose the spots you want to play in. We think spreads and structures will be healthy.
In the past, you were at the U.S. Department of Treasury. You were the chief investment officer of TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program, during the 2008 global financial crisis. You were responsible for managing $700 billion portfolio. So I'm asking an expert here, do you see any systemic worries? And how about private credit? Because there are now people saying that private credit could be a source of systemic risk.
So we don't see that there's real risk in private credit from a systemic perspective. I think what's happened over time is you've actually seen the risk. We think the system has been de-risked by investors who are holding the risk in either unlevered or very lightly levered vehicles that are matched for longer term duration. So that takes it out of the banking system, which is more levered. Mm-hmm. It's funded by deposits, and that's generally a positive thing. So I think risk moving there, generally healthy, and de-risking as opposed to adding systemic risk to the system. I think where there are areas that could improve is just because it's outside the regulated banking system, and mm-hmm. most managers of private credit are still regulated by the SEC and others, is a little more transparency. I think there has been a concern of where it sits, who has exposure to it. And so I think that's a healthy way for people to get more comfortable, is just understanding it. There is a little bit of interconnectedness, which sometimes concerns people. But I think when you dig down and look, what they're talking about is banks yes. are generally providing some leverage to the direct lending firms. And it's in a senior position. So they're taking, effectively the first dollar at the top of the capital structure, they're paid back first. There's a lot of equity below cushion. So it's actually quite reasonable risk. And I think a good function of a bank to help facilitate activity, help work with clients, but actually manage the risk appropriately. And so I generally feel like it's an appropriate system, and it's generally not something that concerns me. I find, and when I look back to the, treasury days, mm-hmm. The three things that tend to cause problems are, lack of capital, liquidity, and confidence. And generally in the system and the way the structure is, the banking system is very healthy, very large capital ratios, liquidity is quite strong, and confidence is good. So I just don't see, the problems in the system anywhere near 2008-09.
So you mentioned banks. You're part of a bank. You're part of Morgan Stanley. And very few banks have a sizable private credit shop. Some did in the past, and they shed them before the big private credit golden era, of course, years back. There's only a handful, maybe you, Goldman Sachs, have private credit in their asset management arm that's sizable and deploying capital with substance. How do you think that happened in Morgan Stanley? Why did they retain it? And why is it so hard for banks to replicate this now? Because for the last couple of years, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I was writing that this bank or that bank wanted to start a private credit asset management arm. And they struggled, and instead they've started partnerships.
Yeah, it's a great question. We are very privileged. Certainly in private credit and equity, where we sit inside of Morgan Stanley, in the sense that you step back, Morgan Stanley, effectively, all we do across the entire firm is help clients raise, manage, and allocate capital, just done in different ways. So we sit here and we are helping investing clients get exposure and ultimately produce alpha. But on the other side, there are borrowers, there are sponsors, they need advice, they need help. And so we get to sit in this ecosystem where our investment banking and capital markets colleagues are just amazing and have relationships across the corporate and financial sponsor spectrum. But they're advising on M&A, they're advising on capital markets, they're helping clients hedge.
Do you think others can replicate your models, or is it just a little too late now?
Look, I think, others do it in different ways. Mm-hmm. And we tend not to look at other banks as our competitors where I sit. There are lots of different...
That's interesting.
There are a lot of different investors and different styles of investors and GPs. They're very large alternative asset managers. They're diversified asset managers. And there are lots of standalone GPs that do certain things very well. So it's a very fragmented industry in asset management compared to investment banking, which tends to be a bit of an oligopoly. So we don't look at another bank as a direct competitor. Oh, if they get into this. Mm-hmm. I think historically, very few have been able to do it, well. But we're fortunate in that we have. It works really well in the U.S. and it works really well in Europe, too.
So right now, the picture that you paint is pretty positive. Not too worried about geopolitical risks, despite all the headlines. A growing economy, decent capital raises, although perhaps it's not as rich and robust as during the golden era. So what are the risks that you see? What do you worry about? Because you're a credit guy half the time. So there must be some worries.
Yeah, we talked about the events that are hard to predict, but something quite large that impacts the overall market and then the confidence, as we talked about before. And if deal activity were to fall because there was a lot of fear and pessimism, that's not good for private equity. It's not good for private credit because you want people to actually be out there doing things, whether they're borrowing or deploying equity. So I think that's one. I think in terms of, you know, more normal or more base case, what we look at is first, you know, you got to look at employment and income. We're talking about, you know, let's just say the U.S. That is a massive driver of activity and ultimately economic growth, which is really important, whether you're a lender or a private equity owner. Very important is seeing underlying, you know, growth, because growth can get you out of a lot of problems, right? You grow, you grow EBITDA, potentially then your coverage ratios are looking a lot better if you're overlevered. So that's number one, certainly something we look at closely. And if that goes, you know, the other way, that could be.
And what is your thought on employment? Because this has been what I mentioned before, sort of a jobless economic boom and a K-shaped recovery where the bottom end is not doing that well. And one of the reasons why the Federal Reserve has been cutting rate is the weak jobs market, weak labor.
Yeah, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, the unemployment rate is still relatively low on a historical basis. And you got to look at the directions. I think there has been a concern because you do look at the lower end and it is weaker. You can look at spending at the lower end, you look at jobs. So that's an issue. And then you also, you know, it's a little bit early to prognosticate, but certainly the expectation is, you know, AI productivity, good for companies, maybe not so good for jobs. And so last year, you may have seen a little bit weaker jobs with companies trying to, frankly, justify the spending that they're putting into AI and have a little bit of productivity gains through layoffs. By and large, though, the numbers look pretty healthy. And then where we sit, we are not agonizing over, you know, a tenth of a point change in either rates or employment. But you do have to look at, you have to look at the trends and ultimately make a judgment of where do you think that's going. But certainly, you know, jobs, important. Rates, certainly important within a band, right? Because it affects confidence. It affects people's appetite to do deals. So when you have rates, you know, going from, you know, 5+ down to 4-3, maybe another 25, 50 basis points seems to be the base case. You know, that's pretty healthy. That's pretty conducive for people saying, yeah, it feels pretty good for me to transact now. And so that's good. But if that changes, then our base case view of M&A sort of picking up steam, you know, might
change. I see.
But you want to look at all of those and look at them sort of, you know, what direction are they going?
What if the Fed no longer cuts, maybe even hikes, because the economy is heating up? And we do have also tax receipts coming back and the big, big, beautiful bill being implemented. So I think there could be a possible worry about the economy overheating. And in that case, what happens to your base case scenario? Is that in that case, is that when M&A sort of gets squashed, or does M&A still is unaffected because the economy is growing so hot and well?
Yeah, a couple of points there. I think the first is we might have a view from the macro, how much M&A is there going to be? Is it going to get weaker, stronger? And that's helpful to know. At the end of the day, every decision, though, is micro. And regardless of economic conditions, there's always a deal to be done. At, you know, it's interesting with the right pricing. So it's not like deal flow completely falls away. So we're always looking at the micro. If we like something, we're not going to worry too much about the macro. But again, putting that, you know, aside, you know, I think if rates, you know, if inflation runs hotter and big and there, and the Federal Reserve, instead of cutting, actually decides to rate, and that becomes a political interesting argument of what they'd be willing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a good day for the markets. I think people will reassess their models. And so many of the deals in the pipeline that people are looking at either selling, buying, probably gets put on hold. Do I think that's our base case or super likely over the next, 6 to 12 months? No, I think it's more likely there'd be a pause rather than cuts. People would digest it. But I think over multiple years, it's a really good point, and something one has to think about is, are we going to be an environment where inflation runs hotter because Fed's not willing or doesn't think it makes sense to raise rates because of labor market? And then, it's a hard job as a Fed, governor, if you're looking at unemployment get worse, but inflation, being up, how do you decide and how do you address that? And those are tougher environments to invest in, right? The investor wants as much as can be certainty, or at least less uncertainty and less volatility. And in the private markets, again, if you can look out, it's hard, but 3, 4, 5 years and understand the risks to a certain business, our job is to mitigate those risks as much as possible and say, under different macro environments, does this work? If rates go to 5%, does this work? How do I think the economy might react in a worsening employment? Am I exposed to that? What if employment runs hot? Do I have a lot of labor inputs?
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of micro analysis that goes into a specific investment that ultimately determines whether or not it's a good investment over a 3, 5, 7 year period.
And moving over to AI, it is the topic when President Trump is not making geopolitical news. What do you say thought on financing AI CapEx? Do you think it's a good place to be credit-wise?
The answer in is it a good place to be? It always depends on pricing and terms.
Okay.
The answer is there's going to be a massive amount of capital required for the build out for $3 trillion over the next 5 years. I don't know, but it's clearly a massive sum. That's going to require equity capital. It's going to require senior debt capital. It's going to require some junior debt capital. So it's going to be interesting. And I think it's also going to be a little bit disparate in terms of good opportunities, maybe not so good. And so that's a good environment too, if you're an active investor trying to find opportunities. I think a lot of capital will come from the public equity and credit markets, but I think also the private markets will have a role to play because, frankly, the demand will be so big. So I think it's quite exciting. You break it down further, a lot of capital will come from the investment grade market, both public and private. And that tends to be the realm of the insurance company capital or insurance affiliated company that has the most amount of capital that really needs to be investment grade. Safer, lower yielding. Tends not to be a place where we do too much. We're sub-investment grade. We're looking at returns that are closer to 10% up to 20%. So not a place where directly we play. But what's interesting is a lot of these structures will also have higher returning, higher risk tranches or exposures that could be interesting or could be really scary. So we'll see. There have been a number of deals done last year, some interesting and some less for the pools of capital and the investors that we have. So I think it will be a pretty exciting time. I think ultimately the investment will be very, very large and have a lot of benefits to the economy, but it will also have winners and losers. I go back and remember the massive build out of the telecom and fiber late 90s, early 2000s. And that was really great infrastructure for the country. But it wasn't great for every company that borrowed a lot and spent a lot. But that infrastructure, physical infrastructure, still exists today and has proved very valuable once the technology caught up and needed all the bandwidth. But it didn't need it in 1999. The technology wasn't there yet. Will this be like that? I don't know. But there's obviously going to be a lot of spend, and it's going to massively transform certain companies and certainly certain sectors. And I think it will take time to diffuse through all the different businesses. I've seen a lot of predictions about, people won't need jobs in 3 years because robots are doing everything.
Yeah.
Things always take a little bit longer, but it is, it's pretty amazing technology. Unlike other technology booms that were very asset light, to be done with very few people and almost very little spending, this does require a very significant amount of capital. And for Morgan Stanley and for private credit, for capital markets, we're there to help clients, you know, raise that capital and ultimately make the investment.
So you're going to be a very busy 2026?
Very busy already. So yes, we do anticipate it'll be very busy. There'll be lots of headlines, but I think a lot of activity will go on.
Great. Thank you so much for joining me, David. This has been great.
Thank you for having me.
And to our audience, thank you for listening and joining. Do join us for another session next week and follow us wherever you get your podcast. This has been Lisa Lee.